25 has a plan to make it easier to fire federal workers. The Biden administration has instituted a rule to try and prevent that. I'm Scott Baba for Pacifica Radio.
COVID Action.
Welcome to Covert Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of Covert Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garava, and we're happy to be here with you on Covert Action Bulletin. Iran carried out a strike over the weekend of April 13th and 14th in retaliation for the Israeli bombing on the 1st of the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria. Embassies are, of course, the sovereign territory of the country represented, effectively making it an Israeli attack on Iran as well as on Syria. In the West, the Iranian response, which was announced in advance and targeted only at a military base, has received significantly more attention. Pundits and politicians are calling it a grave escalation, but that's really the opposite of the reality. And of course, this is all happening while Israel continues its genocide of the Palestinian people with the diplomatic, political, and economic support of the U.S. government. So to get into all of this and the shifting relationships and changes in the Middle East, we are joined by Mazda Majidi, an Iranian author, journalist, and anti-war activist. Mazda, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you on again.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Rachel. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I want to get right into this because there has been so much just disinformation, really, about what happened this past weekend, the night of the 13th, you know, here in the U.S., and what had happened on April 1st. And as we said in the introduction, on April 1st, Israel bombed the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria. Technically a consulate, same thing, though. It's Iranian sovereign territory. That's internationally, consulates, embassies are the territory of the country represented. And so this was effectively, like we said, an attack on Iran. Iran then 2 weeks later almost responds, but they had said, we're going to do this. Here's when it's going to happen. They announced that the missiles were coming. It was missiles. It was drones. They announced with hours to prepare that the missiles were coming, and they targeted not a civilian area, not a diplomatic area, but they targeted a military base. I mean, to me, their response was extremely well measured within the confines of international law. And, you know, not that anyone wants bombing anywhere, but it was fully justified under what Iran is entitled to do when it is struck. How are you looking at the events over the past couple of weeks?
I very much agree, Chris. And I'm glad you started there, because even after the Iranian missile attack started initially, much of the corporate media started with the term retaliatory, but in a lot of outlets, they removed the term retaliatory because, of course, we know in the case of Israel, whether it's Palestinian resistance or Hezbollah or anybody else, everything is supposed to be seen as an aggression on the part of others and not Israel. And in this case, Chris, it was very obvious. Everybody knew it was a retaliation. Iran had been saying for about 2 weeks that they're going to retaliate. And Iran actually took the case as a complaint to a UN Security Council. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't some kind of a gray area or uncertain. I mean, the consulates and embassies are part of are considered internationally as part of that country's territory. I mean, some of our listeners may recall Juliet Assange stayed in the Ecuadorian embassy or consulate in London for something like 7 years. And the reason that the British officials couldn't do it, and it was like essentially a house where, you know, one of their offices was converted to a bedroom where Assange was staying. But because of this international law, the British, you know, officials and military and police couldn't go in because it was considered a part of the Ecuadorian territory. In the case of Iran, when this happened, and it was such a brazen attack that, I mean, there were some reports that even some people within Israel were surprised or weren't consulted of this action. And there was initially, Israel said that, oh, we let the U.S. know. And in fact, the U.S. made a point several times in making statements to Iran and others that we had no knowledge and we had no participation in this. But anyway, so there was no gray area. It was a gross violation of international law. It was unprecedented. I actually don't remember any cases similar at all of a country attacking when, you know, when two countries are not officially at war, one country like bombing and assassinating so many people. 13 people were assassinated, including two top ranking generals. But again, when Iran took it to the UN Security Council, the U.S. representative said something to the effect that, oh, well, we're not even sure if this was part of the Iranian consulate, as if they thought this may have been, I don't know, like a shopping mall or somewhere else. It was clearly what it was. In fact, the residence of the ambassador was hit as well. I mean, he wasn't there, so he survived. But it was very specific. It was not random, and it was carried out by planes by Israel. But the UN Security Council, thanks to the U.S., and not just the U.S., the British and the French, they, you know, they kind of blamed it on Iran's aggression or, you know, things of that nature. And nothing even symbolic happened. But you're right. And any talk of the Iranian response has to be very much framed into a retaliation or response for an action. And we can get into it where essentially Iran had no choice but to do something. They couldn't do nothing after such an attack on their territory.
I think it's unreasonable to imagine, too, Maza, that they would do nothing. I mean, on every level, I mean, both the domestic pressure within their own country, as well as just the reality that Israel is not able, like just kind of how insane this is, you know, like Israel just has this kind of chauvinism, this clear belief that they can do whatever they want in the region. They can bully any country they want to bully. They can continue a genocide in just complete daylight and no one is going to stand in or stop them. So I just think in every way, shape and form, it's very clear. I don't even think the U.S. mainstream media can twist this in a way that this wasn't an obvious need, a legal as well, internationally recognized legal legal retaliation in regards to Iran. I mean, there's no other way to think about it. But, you know, as you're talking, I am wondering, too, if you could go a little bit more into detail as well about some of the thinking behind the choices that Iran made in particular. Because, you know, my read of the situation is that part of the choice of using drones and the type of attack that Iran went with, I think a lot of it had to do with drawing out and being able to see the real capabilities of Israel. I mean, we saw Israel's Iron Dome come into play, and it really did not, in my opinion, hold up in the way that they have been talking about. I mean, they talked about it as if they are completely invincible. And I think to see that Israel is not completely invincible and see that the Iron Dome clearly has a lot of faults, it really puts Iran in a position, not just Iran, but the rest of the world in a position to understand the real capabilities of Israel. But I'd love to hear your thoughts, Mazda, on this.
I mean, first, Rachel, I want to point out how significant it is. I mean, Iran is an oppressed country, a third world country. Third world countries are supposed to just take it. You know, like the U.S. is supposed to bomb them. Israel is supposed to bomb them from planes, from ships, from the ground. And they're supposed to just take the bombings. And essentially, part of Israel's reaction is similar to the U.S. and others. We've seen the U.S., particularly in the Middle East, while occupying Afghanistan and Iraq, brazenly accusing Iran of interfering in other countries' affairs. And this kind of comical type of statement speaks to the colonial mentality that, of course, a colonized country, a third world country, is not supposed to do these things. So I think it's important to point out how significant this is and how so many people in the region, Palestinians in particular, but a lot of people, you know, the masses of people across the region, and many, many Iranians were happy that this happened. And the fact that, you know, technology is a big part of it is also important. Iran and Israel, of course, don't have a border. There's at least two countries between the two. Whatever happened and whatever is going to happen is purely a battle of technology. And to have a third world country who is faced with the whole might of the imperialist establishment, the U.S., Britain, France, and their client states in the region, and the dozens of U.S. bases in the region, that's significant. But I want to go back to the point that you made, Rachel, and a very important point that also Chris made earlier, is that this reaction was very measured, very calibrated. It was not, I know sometimes in the U.S. media, they make it sound like, oh, the crazy mullahs, they're starting a war, a regional war and so forth. But it was as measured and calibrated as it could. It's hard to know how much more damage they could have done or they will be able to do if this escalates. But it is very clear, like Chris was saying, I mean, they announced it up to 72 hours in advance. Well, they said for 2 weeks, we're going to do this. 72 hours earlier, they said, we're going to do this. They told Turkey, they told a number of countries over which the drone would fly. And the targets were clearly military targets. There were no casualties. The one casualty, the young girl who was hit, it was actually like from the inner side. It wasn't like she wasn't anywhere where the target. I think it was the interceptions in midair that caused shrapnel and whatnot to hit her. But anyway, so Iran very much wanted to show that it can defend itself, but it did not want to escalate. It wanted to create this issue. They're not crazy, and they know it's not. They wouldn't really face, in an all-out war, Iran knew they wouldn't just have to face Israel, but the U.S., Britain, and so forth. And Rachel, it's very important what you pointed out. I mean, we don't know because the Israelis always boast of the Iron Dome. Usually they say 90% successful. In this case, they kind of said 99% successful. But as more data came out, it became clear that most of what was intercepted by the British and by the U.S. and the British and even France and even the Jordanians. Or I don't know how much of it was the actual Jordanians or bases within Jordan and so forth. So the Iron Dome did not prove anything. And also the numbers that the Israelis are releasing, they're not showing a whole lot of video on the ground showing the damage. So, you know, a lot of it is boasting, but it is very clear that the attack was not intended to cause maximum damage because the last thing that the Iranians need is an all-out war. If there's one other thing that this whole episode proved, as if it needed to be proven again, is that Iran would not be facing Israel alone, but the whole entire imperialist establishment in the region.
I want to get more into that and some of the other players in the region, but something you said earlier, Mazda, you know, when we were talking about the show and we're kind of brainstorming what this week's show is going to be before the weekend, one of my ideas was to talk about the history of attacks on embassies. And of course, highlighting the U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, which happened in May of 1999, which was done with these GPS-guided JDAM missiles. But the U.S. said, oh, this was a mistake. The CIA director at the time, George Tenet, said this was a mistake. Bill Clinton actually had to apologize for the bombing, which is such a rare thing to do. But, you know, and that was the Chinese embassy. But during the long, drawn out NATO bombing and destruction, the splitting up of Yugoslavia. But it really, you know, makes me think back to that, where they say, oh, this was not intentional. It was an accident, but, you know, they deserved it anyway. And that, like, you know, as you see some of these, you know, politicians and pundits, you know, saying about this attack in Syria. So I've been thinking about that incident quite a bit since April 1st, since that attack. But I do want to talk about some of the other players in the region. Because, you know, as you just said, it would not just be a war between Israel and Iran. It would be a war between, I mean, the U.S. would be involved, the U.K. You know, we heard reports that Jordan in some ways contributed to the defense of Israel, whether it was shooting down missiles, things like that. We also have reports that the UAE and Saudi Arabia shared intelligence with Israel and the U.S. that they had gathered on specifics about the types of missiles or the types of weaponry and exactly when this was going to happen. So, you know, I think that a lot of people who don't know better in the Middle East, you know, kind of don't have an understanding of who the different players are, where their allegiances are. So can you, for our listeners, walk through kind of Jordan, UAE, Saudi Arabia, and other countries in the region that are playing an important role or would play an important role if there were a further escalated conflict between Iran and Israel, to talk about where their allegiances lie and kind of why? Because this is a history of colonialism and we have to look at it through that lens.
Okay, that's a good place to go, Chris. I mean, I think because the corporate media in the U.S., their coverage of the region is so shallow, you know, on purpose. I mean, you're given the impression that poor old Israel is surrounded by the sea of Arabs, all of whom want it destroyed. And this actually, as far as the state of Israel is concerned, you know, the Arab masses in the region, they don't have a whole lot of love for the, you know, colonial settler state of Israel. But the state, the governments of these Arab countries, that's a whole different story. I want to go back to a statement that the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the leading left organization in the Palestinian resistance in the 1970s, led by George Habash, used to emphasize is that the Palestinian struggle faces three enemies. One is Zionism, one is imperialism, and one is Arab reactionary governments. And this last part is very important for us to understand. And one reason that the Palestinian resistance has such a hard time making any gains is that while the Arab masses overwhelmingly support the Palestinian resistance, the Arab states do not. It's hard to, you know, remember, it's almost hard to remember that prior to this, prior to October of 2023, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, was saying it's just a matter of weeks or months before we sign on to the Abraham Accords, meaning Saudi Arabia recognizing Israel, opening embassies, you know, all this kind of stuff. And you know that the Saudi Arabian government plays a leadership role in the region, including United Arab Emirates, Oman, Kuwait, and others. So when we're talking about the role that they play, we have to keep in mind that strategically, they're much, much more closely allied with the U.S. and Israel than they are with Iran. Even that statement is inaccurate because they're enemies of Iran. The thing that changed, though, just last year was that for years, and this is almost forgotten now as well, but for years, Saudi Arabia in particular, bin Salman in particular, were asking the U.S., when are you going to attack Iran? When are you going to occupy Iran? It wasn't just Netanyahu. Of course, Netanyahu has been trying for 20 years to get the U.S. to invade Israel, but it was them too. It was Saudi Arabia and UAE. They considered Iran to be an existential threat to them, and they wanted the U.S. to invade. In fact, the reason that they changed course and reestablished diplomatic relations with Iran is that they kind of gave up on that hope. They gave up on the hope of the U.S. invading and occupying, and they also gave up on the hope of a U.S.-Israeli-supported opposition movement within Iran, the so-called Women Life Freedom Movement, the right-wing foreign imperialist paid movement to succeed. So when they realize, okay, the Islamic Republic of Iran is there, the U.S. isn't going to invade and occupy, internal forces are not going to overthrow the state, so we need to do something. So it has become more complicated because while it is very, very true that Saudi Arabia, UAE, and others very much want the Iranian state to be overthrown, they're not putting a whole lot of stock into that possibility. Therefore, I mean, Chris, I've heard also that they provided some intelligence to the, you know, U.S. and the Israelis and so forth. But I would guess that it's not going to be that significant, and I would guess that it's going to be deniable. The case of Jordan, however, is different because I think their participation was pretty overt and difficult to hide.
Certainly, Mazda. I mean, one of the things, too, I'm curious about in terms of Jordan specifically is how the Jordanian population is going to be responding to the government's actions. I there's just so many things that just ring to me immediately when you see about how Jordan intervened in this, that I was like, yeah, this is not going to go over well at all with the population. You know, I'd like to return to this point you made about the role of the other imperialists in intervening in relationship to the Iron Dome, but also just kind of seeing the way that the British, the French, the United States have played a role in this situation. It says a lot to me about immediately where their interests lie and ultimately where the imperialists are what they're really thinking. I mean, regardless of how these countries have to react to people on the ground, to grassroots movements, it is so clear that these imperialist countries, that the West has everything to gain and everything to benefit from this genocide and everything to gain and everything to benefit from Israel maintaining its strategic position in the Middle East. So I would love to hear some of your thoughts on kind of the inter-imperialist elements here as well, how the British have been reacting in this conflict, how the French have been reacting in this conflict, and if there are splits. And to me, in some ways, the way that they've reacted recently shows that the splits feel very much so on the surface, but I'm curious your analysis of the different imperialist powers that are involved here.
Well, I've seen this actually among a lot of people who have illusions about the European imperialists being genuinely pro human rights and democracy and so forth. And of course, in a lot of cases, I mean, the U.S. does that too, but in the case of U.S., it's a lot more obvious since the U.S. is the side dropping the bombs and doing the mass killings and so forth, whether it be Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or many other cases. The Europeans, in a lot of cases, they pose as like governments with deep respect for human rights and so forth. And among a lot of intellectuals in the Third World, this kind of propaganda has some effect. So like I know a lot of these types of intellectuals within Iran who actually think, oh, the French, the Germans, they are going to condemn human rights violations. But I mean, the last 6 months has laid bare how superficial it is, because like these same forces, when it's an independent country that they're trying to overthrow, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, they can spend years talking about one young woman who died, who, as it turned out, this whole other story, she wasn't even killed. She had a brain condition and tumors and so forth. But even if it were true, they spent a year or more defending the human rights of this one individual, while every day, every hour, hundreds of Palestinians, the majority of them children, women, non-combatants, are being killed. And all of a sudden, the concerns of human rights are down to, well, maybe Israel should use other tactics to minimize civilian casualties. That's the thing. That's the extent that they will go to defend human rights. So it is very shallow. And yes, when push comes to shove, they will defend Israel, because Israel is not just a state that happens to be there, but it is their solid base for repressing independence movements, nationalist movements, socialist movements in the region. And they can rely on Israel like they can rely on none other. Now, the other point, though, is that I think there is genuine differences in the interests that the imperialists have. Even U.S. imperialism has with Israel. They're not always the same. I always emphasize the case of Iran to people who in the U.S. and elsewhere say, Israel controls U.S. foreign policy, which is not true. If you look at the size of the states, if you look at the size of the capitalist economies, that doesn't even make sense. But case in point is the case of Iran. It is very true that in the case of Iran, right after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the so-called cakewalk invasion, it wasn't just the neocons in the U.S., the Richard Perles and Wolfowitz and John Bolton and them basically saying that, quote, real men go to Tehran, saying that the U.S. should follow up the U.S. invasion of Iraq with the U.S. invasion of Iran. It was Netanyahu. It was the Israeli ruling class who pushed and pushed and pushed for years. And through the administrations of Bush II and Obama and even Trump and Clinton, all of them, the U.S. refused to invade Iran. For Israel, this is a pretty simple thing, because Israel wouldn't have to do anything. I mean, we can talk about that now as to how much damage Israel can do. But certainly Israel does not have the capability of invading Iran or overthrowing the Islamic Republic or anything. So Israel likes that option because the U.S. will bear the cost, human costs, economic costs, possibly diplomatic costs, and so forth. So the difference is the extreme expansionism of the Israeli state, the overtly fascistic elements of the Israeli state, the ultra-right-wing Israeli state that where there are elements that actually say, yes, we should starve the population of Palestine. Golan saying these are human animals, the Palestinians are, and we treat them accordingly. This kind of stuff is not in the interest of the U.S. The U.S. and the European imperialists obviously want Israel to survive. They want Israel to be strong. They want Israel to be available to repress liberation movements in the region. But they don't want Israel to create a situation which it has, where all virtually the entire people of the region are unified against Israel, and they can see the U.S. support for the Israeli state. And for these reasons, there are serious differences between the two. Well, just focusing on the U.S. and the Biden administration. Yes, they will arm Israel to the teeth. No, they don't want Israel to escalate this into a regional war. They don't want Israel to push all the Palestinians out of Gaza through Rafah into Egypt, because these would be too extreme. And U.S. imperialism has no interest in Israel getting even larger and alienating the people in the region even more.
And I think there's also this aspect of, because this is not happening in a vacuum, there's the aspect of Russia that comes into this. And I say this because, in particular, two things that are happening over the last 12, 18 hours. One is reportedly a call between Putin and the president of Iran, but also the German foreign minister flying to Israel. And what they're saying on the headlines is that she's going there to de-escalate tensions, but she's also putting out statements that EU nations now need to reconsider extending sanctions on Iran. Apparently the EU had been thinking about lightening up some of the sanctions, but now she has said that, you know, that the EU should, as a, you know, united front, continue and strengthen sanctions against Iran. I have this quote here from her. This is Annalena Baerbock, the German foreign minister, saying, "Iran is playing with the fate of all people in the Middle East. This applies above all to Iran and to its proxies and proxy groups such as Hezbollah or the Houthis." And last time you were on in January, Mazda, we talked at length about it's not reality that these groups, Hezbollah, the Houthis, they are not just proxies of Iran. They, you know, and people should go back and listen to that. I believe it was in January of this year that we had that excellent conversation. But I think the conversation happening between Iran and Russia is also part of the EU imperialists' calculations at this point. Because Russia has been, in many ways, an ally to Iran, economically, certainly, but also militarily and diplomatically. And so we have to see it in that, but also to extend even further, to extend this into why does the U.S. not necessarily want a conflict with Iran? Well, it's going into conflict with China. I was watching a baseball game on TV the other night, and I noticed some writing on the field. And I thought it was just an advertisement, but it turns out it was an advertisement for an organization that wants to hire people to build ships for AUKUS, the Australia-UK-US partnership. The website was like buildsubmarines.com, and they explicitly are celebrating that they are building submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, for the Australian Navy as part of this partnership, which is meant entirely to encircle China. So to me, it's not that the U.S. doesn't want to overthrow Iran. I think this is what you were saying. It's not that the U.S. doesn't, the capitalists, the imperialists don't want to overthrow Iran. It's that it's not the target right now that they're looking for. It's that it is a goal, but it is not their primary goal right now. And so looking at the way the EU and the U.S. are approaching this, I don't think that a German foreign minister's trip is going to actually calm down any tensions in the region, especially while she's talking about sanctions, first of all, because sanctions are war. And I'm sure that there were diplomatic conversations between Germany, the UK, the US about the sanctions as well. But I'm wondering if you could actually, since we're, you know, I brought up sanctions, talk about how the sanctions have impacted Iran a little bit too, because, you know, Israel is reportedly preparing a military response. This is something that has been known since the night of the 13th. But at the same time, the sanctions don't get as much attention. They're not, I hate to say it, not as flashy, but the sanctions can have devastating effects on a country. You're listening to Covert Action Bulletin, the official show and podcast of Covert Action Magazine. where we've been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. We'll be right back with more of our conversation with Mazza Majidi.
I am not afraid. I am not afraid. I will die for liberation, 'cause I know why I was made. I am not afraid. I am not afraid. I will die for liberation, 'cause I know why I was made. I am not afraid. I am not afraid. I will die for liberation, 'cause I know why I was made. I am not afraid. I am not afraid. I will die for liberation, 'cause I know why I was made. I am not afraid. I am not afraid.
Welcome back. You're listening to Covert Action Bulletin. Covert Action has been exposing the covert action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. We're back now with more of our conversation with Mazza Majidi.
Yes. And the point also that we have to emphasize that, again, we're not talking about the U.S. sanctioning Iran, even if it's not the EU or whether it is or not. It's almost insignificant at this point because international trade is done in dollars. And the U.S. has pledged and has carried out that pledge to punish third parties, whether it be companies or states that deal with Iran. So Iran has been trying to survive in a world economy where it can trade with great difficulties. It has to trade through intermediaries. It has to trade. It has to use barter, or it has to trade with like countries, states that are strong enough to not be impacted that much by U.S. sanctions. And we know that since last year, the number one purchaser of Iran's oil is now China. But yes, the sanctions have been a means to, it's a form of war. I totally agree with what you said, Chris. And I don't know, some people might remember the sanctions on Iraq where it basically pushed the entire population into hunger and starvation. People were dying. The hospitals had nothing, like no anesthesia. People were dying. And that's where the infamous quote of the, it's worth it, of Madeleine Albright saying it's worth it, the sanctions are worth it, no matter how many lives of children they cost. That's when that happened. But yes, the sanctions, the problem with the sanctions is that while from the imperialist perspective is that they have been effective to the point of weakening Iran's economy. They have been effective to the point of slowing down its growth and in some years actually reversing its growth. But they haven't been effective to the point because Iran was in a much stronger position than Iraq was at the beginning of the U.S. Sanctions in the 90s. And we have to remember that the sanctions of Iraq came right after the U.S. deliberately destroyed their infrastructure, water purification facilities, power facilities, and so forth. That the sanctions followed that. But in the case of Iran, Iran's state is reasonably strong and Iran has not been paralyzed. The economy has experienced problems that it certainly wouldn't have if it were in sanction, but it hasn't had the desired effect of causing an overthrow. It has had the effect, the desired effect of causing dissatisfaction because of some shortages and so forth. But again, generally speaking, in the Iranian market, consumer products are widely available. But it has made it difficult for the economy to thrive and has required a lot of acrobatics on the part of Iranian state to be able to trade, to be able to bring in, to import whatever is needed. So yes, I think it's very important to talk about the sanctions because that's an ongoing thing. And again, when we run into this notion that Iran and the Islamic Republic are just aggressive and they want to start wars and so forth, I mean, talk about the sanctions that have been ongoing. And I don't even want to go into the JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that the U.S. and others signed and the Trump administration brazenly violated, and Iran was left to deal with the reimposition of the sanctions, another violation of international law. Just want to add, I mean, two things, Chris. It's very important what you said, that U.S. imperialism, it's not like the 1970s. Oil is still important, but it doesn't play the critical role that it played in those years. And the U.S. is a major producer of oil now. You know, in the world economy, again, I'm not going to say oil is not important, but the super laser focus of the imperialists on the Middle East is no longer justified by the facts on the ground. And the pivot to Asia, as they like to call it, is very important for them. So that's one reason that the U.S. doesn't want to spend the next 5-10 years with more wars and occupations in the bombings in the Middle East. The other thing is, you know, the masses of these countries. I mean, I think, Rachel, you talked about Jordan earlier. I mean, Jordan is known as a, I know that in the U.S. media, we hear about independent states as being very repressive. But the reality is, like Jordan, their intelligence service, their CIA, Mossad, is second to none. They are admired by the likes of Mossad because of how violent, how extremely repressive they are. But there's still this concern that a regional war will unleash, you know, the masses, not just in Jordan, but elsewhere. With the events that happened just, you know, less than a decade ago, Bahrain was close to collapsing. I mean, Saudi Arabia had to bring in troops to keep the Bahraini Al-Khalifa family from being overthrown. So the problem with the regional war is, yes, the Arab states, most of the Arab states will either support it overtly or covertly. But the problem is, what does that do to the Arab masses who see the genocide going on in Palestine, and you see one state in the region genuinely, materially supporting Palestinian resistance, and that being Iran, and that state being attacked by Israel or the U.S. or some combination thereof?
Certainly, Mazda, there's so much to get into. I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking a lot about kind of the question of what comes next. I mean, regional war is what is on everybody's mind. And, you know, especially with what the potential response from Israel will be. I really appreciate your analysis earlier where you're sharing more about the differences between the U.S. and Israel's point of view in this war. I mean, the U.S. really doesn't want Israel to move further into Rafah. The U.S. does not want to see that happen. And it's interesting to see how Israel has also hesitated, I think, because of that as well. There's so much pressure, too, domestically in Israel from the population to continue to go down this path. So it is an interesting kind of inflection point that we're in this war. And so I'd love to hear from you a bit more of your analysis of the potential of regional war, what it looks like, because I do think, to your point earlier, this choice that Iran has made has been very measured. I mean, the choice of attack has been very measured. Like you've said, it's very much so about as much as possible preventing escalation. But the escalation that Israel could bring, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. Whether or not the U.S. also supports it, we'll have to see plays out, and what role the U.S. plays in that. You know, Israel in a lot of ways wants to come after Iran because it's the only state in the region that would warrant the kind of U.S. involvement that they are possibly looking for. So there's a lot here. And I'd love to get a bit of your speculation or perhaps a bit of your response to some of what I feel is a little bit overblown. I mean, you know, people are saying all over social media, especially TikTok, like this is the opening salvo of World War III. And you never know how these things go. I mean, escalation is there. There's always potential in escalation. But I think that as we've laid out already, there are so many other deterring factors that change what a regional war would look like if it were to happen.
Well, I think from Iran's perspective, the worst scenario would have been if the U.S. declared its full support for Israel bombing it and then the U.S. getting involved. And I think part of the reason that Iran's response, retaliation, was so calibrated and measured was that it wanted to show that it will defend itself, but it didn't want to force the hand of the Israelis and the U.S. to engage in an all-out war. So, I mean, one thing that we have to emphasize, we cannot underestimate the military capability of Israel. We should not, but at the same time, we shouldn't overestimate it either. Again, like I said, Israel does not have a border with Iran. It can like send missiles to Iran, and Iran's air defenses are nothing compared to the Iron Dome. Yes, Israel exaggerates Iron Dome, but it is a very advanced air defense system, and Israel doesn't have anything close to that. So Israel can, and in my estimation, they likely will target some facilities. What's coming out is that they will likely hit, you know, either the nuclear facilities, the non-military nuclear facilities of Iran, maybe military facilities and so forth. Whether it's Iran or Israel in this case, there are limits to what missiles can do. I mean, missiles have to travel thousands of miles. So their cargo of explosives is somewhere between 100 and 150 kilograms. I'm no expert on these things, but I do know that where the U.S. and Israel, the U.S. drops bombs, like 1,000 kilograms of bombs, we can imagine how much their mega bombs, how much damage can do to destroy a city block. You can't do that level of damage with missiles. I mean, the operation by Iran on the 13th did have the effect of creating panic, creating fear in all parts of Israel. And for that, it was very effective. And Israelis are not used to that as much because it's supposed to be Israel bombing others and not the other way around. But whether it's Iran bombing Israel or Israel bombing Iran through missiles and drones and so forth, we're looking at something that things that could have more psychological impact than actual impact. Iran is a huge country. And how many missiles is Israel going to throw Iran's way? Even if Iran cannot intercept one of them, again, it's not something where they can flatten the cities or anything like that. Similarly, with Iran, it's not like they can destroy Tel Aviv or anything like that. So the question is, I think I do agree with you, Rachel. It's very exaggerated to think that World War III is already underway. Again, from what is likely to happen from what is coming out, Israel's response will be somewhat limited as well. One, to placate to some extent the U.S. and even the European imperialists saying, okay, we kind of listened to you. We didn't go all out. But then the other thing is, how much damage can they do? As strong as Israel's military is and air force is, again, they don't have the capability of flattening Tehran or anything like that. The other major problem that Israel has is that like military jets, fighter jets, have a relatively limited range. So if Israel, outside of missiles, if Israel wanted to send military jets, first of all, they'd have to pass through airspace of at least a couple of countries, which they couldn't do if the U.S. didn't authorize them to do that. But even if they did, they'd have to figure out a way to leave fuel in the air because Israel and Iran are not that close. And military jets are not like these commercial jets where they go halfway around the globe or something. So if we're talking about missiles, then the question will be, to what extent will they do it? And will Iran necessarily respond immediately? Or will they say, we will respond in due time in the appropriate manner, sort of ending the escalation. So if I had to guess, Rachel, and obviously it is very dangerous and we have to fear all of that, but if I had to guess, I would say that this round of confrontation will be limited to volleys of missiles, but not going far beyond that.
Certainly, Mazda. You know, I wanted to say, and Chris, I know you want to get in here as we get to the end of the show, but I really appreciate that perspective. I mean, we can never know where things go. I mean, that's the reality of the way these things kind of play out in terms of war and escalation. But I do think at minimum as well, this idea that within Israeli society, there's a new sense of panic. I do think that that is going to also play a role in Israel's decision making, which I do think is kind of unique in a lot of ways. Like, it's kind of like, yeah, you know, Israel, they can corner and bomb, especially Palestinians who have been, you know, defanged in a lot of ways of what their capabilities could be. I mean, they're in every way, shape and form in an apartheid state, but they're going against Iran. They're going against countries that are not in the same position as Palestinians. So I do think some of that hubris, you know, amongst the population certainly would wear off and possibly change domestically the kind of calculations that are being made, or perhaps not. But Chris, I'd love for you to get in here.
Well, certainly. I think that you're absolutely right on that, Rachel. And, you know, we know that the Israeli war cabinet has met at least five times since Sunday morning. You know, another one, we're recording this on Tuesday the 16th, just another one today, this morning. And they have not responded, but said that they will. And so it remains to be seen. We don't have fortune. You know, we're not fortune tellers. We don't have crystal balls. Life would be a lot easier if we did. But we can look at what we know and, you know, look at the analysis that we've been talking about today. But I also want to take this back to tie this back to, first of all, the anti-war movement and the Palestine solidarity movement in the U.S. in our last few minutes, because we also know, as of this morning, the U.S. Navy reports that the Navy itself, just the Navy, has spent $1 billion just on what they call munitions over the last 6 months to what they say is to thwart 130 direct attacks on military and merchant ships in the Middle East. This is coming from the U.S. Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro, and he's been in Congress today pushing for another $2 billion just for the U.S. Navy. So we're not talking Air Force, Army, Marine Corps, you know, all of that. Or Space Force. You know, Space Force is now a thing we do need to consider. At the same time, April 15th was tax day in the U.S., and many people filed their taxes and sent that check over to the IRS. And we have to look at, you know, in the U.S., $1 billion on munitions, thousands of miles away from the United States, and it doesn't benefit U.S. workers in any way. It doesn't benefit us at all. In fact, it makes the situation worse for everyone around the globe to have the Navy in these areas. At the same time, on the 15th, there were these massive demonstrations. They shut down O'Hare Airport. They shut down Pratt & Whitney, a weapons manufacturer here in Connecticut. The Golden Gate Bridge. I think the Brooklyn Bridge as well. It was this coordinated day of actions, really significant actions, continuing to say no more business as usual. And I thought it was very important for that to happen on tax day to make the connection that much of this could not be happening without the U.S. funding this war and the genocide against Palestinians, but also the bigger picture, the nearly half the budget or more that's spent on the Pentagon, which is not a defensive force, but in fact, an offensive force. And that's why it's so important for us to continue building an anti-war movement that, if things do escalate, is out saying no attacks on Iran, end the genocide of Palestinians, end U.S. aid to Israel. So we have to keep this in mind, too, that while I think a lot of the influencers who are saying this is World War III, they are certainly overblowing it. We don't know when escalation is going to happen. And so we do have to be alert. But I think in our last few minutes, Mazda, if you want to give your thoughts on that and building and strengthening the anti-war movement, I think that would be a great place for us to go.
Yeah, I know. As you know, Chris, for all of us activists, one of the big challenges is connecting the international arena to what's going on here, because to the average person, it may appear like, oh, why do I care about what goes on in Palestine or in Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya? Let's just focus on here. And it also, it compounds that the fact that right wing of the U.S. establishment has really for decades, but certainly in the recent years with the MAGA crowd and Trump, created this anti-tax atmosphere that is actually laser focused on those aspects of taxes that do provide some measure of protection for parts of the working class. You know, like as always, overwhelmingly, it's a racist attack, supposedly on, you know, black and brown people who are recipients of support, whether it's children or anti-poverty measures or whatever. But it seems like April 15th is the good, you know, situation to bring the attention of people. If you're against taxes, guess where most of your taxes are going on an ongoing basis, whether it's Israel's $4 or $5 billion a year, or, you know, the other things that the U.S. spends on the Ukraine, on all the client states around the globe, on the, you know, hundreds of military bases, and all of the profit guaranteed contracts that the U.S. government has with so-called defense contractors, where taxpayer money are given to these huge corporations. It's very relevant, and I think it's very important for us to always emphasize that the U.S. empire, it's, you know, Navy and Army and Air Force and Marines around the world are not protecting the interests of us, are not protecting the interests of working people in America, but really the bankers and the big corporations and so forth. And if you want to save money in terms of paying taxes, you won't do it by cutting some measure of a safety net for the poorest of the poor, but here's where your cuts can be. And much of the defense spending is hidden. It's not even in the $900 billion official, but, you know, like the VA budget and everything else. And the specifics, like Chris was saying, that if for specific actions, they go to Congress and invariably, successfully, they get funding from Congress for various things. And the individual wars, by the way, like the Iraq and Afghanistan, have their own budgets. So it's very important for us to point out that while we are, in fact, defending the right of self-determination for the people around the globe, the right that is being violated on a daily basis by the U.S. government, we are, in fact, fighting for the interests of the working class in the U.S. as well, who gain nothing from all this spending of the empire around the world. And what could end up, you know, feeding the people, providing housing to the people, schools, hospitals, and whatnot, is being essentially dollars being burned, destroyed, funding going to causes that have no benefits for the American people.
Certainly, Mazda, you know, I'll throw this in here as we come to a close. You know, the U.S. since the 1940s has given Israel $260 billion. I mean, it's really staggering to think about the amount of tax dollars that have gone to Israel, and especially considering everything that they've done. And I actually recently looked up as well the other alternatives of what you could have done with that money. $125 billion would have actually covered the entire U.S.'s backlog of bridge repairs. So in the same amount of time, we could have instead fixed all the bridges, or for something, I think it was $190 million, we could fix all the U.S. public schools, K-12 schools in the United States. So when you really just start getting a sense of scale of how much our tax dollars are going to war and going to this genocide, it really disturbs you because of just the state of the United States. But there is so much more we could talk about, but we are going to have to leave it right there. But before we go, we've been joined by Mazda Majidi, who is an Iranian author, journalist, and anti-war activist. And I want to remind you, if you like what you heard today and you want to support independent journalism, go to patreon.com/covertactionmagazine and become a patron. We can only do this show with the support of our listeners. So if you want to hear more, be sure to go to our Patreon to support. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Scarafa. Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York. If you've missed any of our episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts by searching for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archive. So we are all out of time for today. Thanks for listening to Covert Action Bulletin.
Covert Action.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. The Supreme Court today agreed to hear the Biden administration's challenge to a transgender care ban in Tennessee. The state law enacted last year bans hormone therapy and puberty blockers for minors and imposes civil penalties for doctors who violate the prohibitions. It is among a growing number of state laws enacted in recent years targeting transgender care. In taking the case, the justices will consider whether the Tennessee law violates the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. The case is set to be argued before the court this fall. In other news, one person has died in South Dakota and hundreds of homes have been destroyed in Iowa during flooding in the upper U.S. Midwest. Some rivers in the two states reached record high levels as up to 18 inches of rain fell in some areas over the weekend. In South Dakota, Governor Kristi Noem declared a state of emergency while warning that the worst of the flooding was expected today and tomorrow. And in Iowa, Governor Kim Reynolds on Sunday requested an expedited presidential disaster declaration for her state. In doing so, the governor asked for federal assistance for 22 counties, according to a statement from her office. And after breaking temperature records across the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic states and Midwest last week, an unusually early heat wave is forecast to shift to portions of the Southeast and Southern Plains today. Potential highs in the low 100s are forecast for some regions, according to the National Weather Service. As the week goes on, the heat is expected to start climbing again in the Mid-Atlantic, possibly rising back toward triple digits by Wednesday. Climate change is driving more severe extreme heat events around the world, scientists say. In recent years, global warming has made heat waves hotter, more frequent, and longer. In international news, officials in Saudi Arabia have confirmed at least 1,300 people died in the extreme heat during this year's Hajj pilgrimage. Temperatures at times reached as high as 125 degrees Fahrenheit. More than 1.83 million Muslims from 22 countries participated in the pilgrimage this year, according to Saudi Arabia's Hajj Authority. The pilgrimage is a mandatory religious duty for all financially and physically able Muslims to complete at least once in their lifetime. Saudi Arabia's health minister said that 83% of the 1,300 fatalities were unauthorized pilgrims who walked long distances in soaring temperatures to perform the Hajj rituals in and around the holy city of Mecca. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu threw cold water on a U.S.-backed plan to end the 8-month war in Gaza, saying late yesterday he would only be willing to agree to a partial ceasefire. Netanyahu's interview on a conservative Israeli station was met with anger from Israeli families of hostages held by Hamas, who believe only a full ceasefire will bring back their loved ones. Hamas has insisted that it will not release the remaining hostages without a permanent ceasefire deal and the full withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 86 degrees under fair skies. In New York City, 79 degrees under mostly cloudy.